given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up.
Welcome to Illuminations. I'm Renee Moran. Today, I'm joined by Cassie Hammett, founder and director of the Hub Urban Ministries, a nonprofit which works to aid the homeless and women and children who have been sex trafficked or work in prostitution or as exotic dancers. Cassie founded the Hub Urban Ministries in 2007 at the age of 22 after assisting in getting to know homeless people in Shreveport. The Hub has two main ministries, the Lovewell Center and Purchased, Not For Sale. She sits on the Governor's Commission for Human Trafficking Prevention and the Human Trafficking Federal Task Force in Louisiana. She also works as a consultant for other cities who are launching models of the Hub. Cassie, welcome and thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Cassie, tell me about the history of how the Hub Urban Ministries began.
Yeah, so I'm really thankful to be on today. And just the little bio that you gave kind of tells a little bit of the story of the Hub. So I was super young. I was a baby when what I didn't know at the time was the Hub was started, because it was an unintentional on my part to start a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. It was really organically grown out of friendship with the poor, friendship with those living on the street. And it was a very organic process as we, my husband and I, and then because I'd been raised in Shreveport, my groups of friends began to engage in relationship with those that would be considered marginalized. You know, we, through those friendships, realized the gaps that existed in their life. We just took the steps to start meeting those needs and start filling those gaps. And quite quickly, kind of a movement was born out of that, that eventually became the Hub. So it started out of the trunk of my car. I don't have a degree to run it. I didn't, you know, set out to start a nonprofit, but I love that part of the story of the Hub, because it was started out of friendship with the poor, and it still is sustained by that. And so that's kind of a very small nutshell of a very long story, but that's how the Hub got started.
The Lovewell Center, the Hub's mission to assist with homelessness, works as a membership program, which is different. So what services does the Lovewell Center offer, and why is membership important?
So the model of the Lovewell Center has three factors or three approaches that make it unique. The first one being that it is a membership-based resource center. And that part of the puzzle, the importance of the membership, is that when you are a member somewhere, that speaks to you belonging there. For a lot of the populations that we serve at the Hub, it has been a long time since they belonged somewhere, whether that's in a family or even in an establishment inside of somewhere in the city. A lot of those that we serve on the street don't belong anywhere. And so the membership part is a way for us to give them the opportunity, not just to be somewhere, but to belong somewhere and to be expected to be there. So that's the first thing that makes the Lovewell Center different and unique. The second factor is that we are an earning and empowerment resource center. So inside of the Lovewell, we have resource stores that address the material needs of those in material poverty, but none of those resources are free. And so members have the opportunity through classes, counseling, projects around the building, and even turning in their own work stubs if they have a job. All of that can be translated to credits on their membership account that they can then use to shop inside of our resource stores. The importance of that is it speaks to the idea that God created all of us in his image, and God created all of us with a purpose, and he has a very unique purpose and plan for each of us. And what can happen for individuals in poverty and homelessness is they get distance between what God created them for and what their current reality is. And so through earning and empowerment, through taking that stance in their life, what we're saying to them is, you belong here, but we also believe that you have something to offer this equation. We believe that you were created to engage in your own life and that God has given you a set of skills and talents and abilities that just need to be uncovered. And so through going to classes, through all of the efforts to earn the things that they need, it restores back this dignity of being involved and participating in their own life. So that's the second feature. The third is the power of choice. So the LoveWell returns this idea of choice back to our members. When they earn, they can choose how they earn their credits on their membership account, but they can also choose how they spend them. And so often when you're in poverty and homelessness, your choices are severely limited. My kids always say, you get what you get and you don't throw a fit. But living in poverty, often that is the way, because you're in survival mode, that you don't get to choose what you really want, or even a lot of times what you actually need. You have to just take what someone will give you. And so at the LoveWell Center, we're trying to reverse that mindset and say, hey, not only do you now have the opportunity to earn what you need, but you get to choose the things that you spend that hard-earned, those hard-earned credits on. And so it gives them the opportunity to choose clothes that they like, clothes that fit them, to choose a bag of groceries that they'll actually eat, or that meet their, you know, their health needs or their medical needs. And so those three kind of features of the LoveWell make us one unique, but are what makes the LoveWell model so powerful. So that would be belonging, earning and empowerment, and choice.
And who does the LoveWell serve?
So the LoveWell serves individuals facing material poverty and those experiencing homelessness. That's kind of the general population that we serve.
Both men and women?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Let's talk about your other program, Purchased. What does Purchased Not For Sale mean?
So Purchase is a ministry that reaches women and children who have experienced or who are experiencing sexual exploitation and human trafficking. And so Purchased was, the name Purchased came out of the verses in Corinthians that say, speaking of Jesus, that we've been bought already. We've been bought with a price. We're no longer for sale. And so the idea of the name is that we've already been purchased by Jesus, that is something that has already happened, and that our value is so much higher than anything anyone could offer in exchange for us. And so that's kind of where that name came from. But it speaks to the fact that the populations that we serve, often a monetary value has been placed on their lives. And for a lot of their lives, they have actually been sold as a commodity. And so it just kind of speaks to the reality that in the eyes of Jesus, that his blood already purchased them and that they are no longer for sale. So that's kind of where that name came from.
There's a lot of terminology used when talking about prostitution and sex trafficking. And I'm hoping you can clarify, what's the difference between prostitution and sex trafficking?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the line between prostitution and human trafficking there's an answer for adults and then there's an answer for children. So I'm going to answer for adults first. The difference between a woman in prostitution and a victim of trafficking comes down to consent. So the word consent, basically when consent is removed and someone is forced to perform sexual acts, that goes from prostitution to human trafficking. So that can be at the hands of a pimp, or a family member. Like, it doesn't have to be sort of in this box of it just being a pimp. So there's three words that legally they use to determine if someone is an adult, is considered a victim of trafficking. And those three words are force, fraud, or coercion. So if any of those three things have happened in that individual's life connected to sexual exploitation, that individual can be considered a victim of trafficking in the legal system. Does that make sense? I can clarify that more. Mm-hmm. And so there is a line between a woman engaging in the sex industry and a victim of trafficking. But that line is that word consent. If consent has been removed by force, fraud, or coercion, then that technically that woman would be considered, or man would be considered, a victim of trafficking. So that's the difference for adults. For children, there is no difference between a child in prostitution and a victim of trafficking. So technically, we can just erase out of our vocabulary child prostitution, because that actually isn't a thing legally. So a child that has experienced sexual exploitation, which is something of commercial value, has been exchanged in exchange for a sexual act. If that has happened to a child once or a thousand times, doesn't matter. That child is always considered a victim of human trafficking. And so what that means is that the law protects that child, and there cannot be a criminal charge placed on that child for the crime of prostitution. So we can kind of erase child prostitute out of our minds and just know that because a child cannot consent, anytime a child is involved in commercial sexual exploitation, they are considered a victim of sex trafficking.
How do sex traffickers recruit women?
So the way that we describe recruitment of sex trafficking is the exploitation of human need. And that goes for adults or children. Often you see that recruiters or pimps will kind of find a hook into a potential victim's life. And that hook is almost always a gap in their needs being met. So I don't know if people listening have ever seen Maslow's triangle of need, hierarchy of needs. If you've ever seen that triangle, basically it's just, and you can Google it. It's a way to depict human need, like what all of us have in common. And it starts with the most basic things, our most basic survival needs being met. And as you move up that triangle, it goes towards more emotional fulfillment. And so that triangle is a really good picture of how recruitment actually happens. So often a recruiter or a pimp or an individual wanting to use someone for commercial gain sexually will look at that person's life through a relationship typically and find the gaps in their needs and be the person that meets those needs. And that's why we call it the exploitation of human need. Is because at the bottom of every story, every victim was exploited first by a person looking at their life and exploiting their actual needs, whether that was something to eat, a place to stay, or even some of those emotional needs being met, wanting to belong somewhere, wanting intimacy, wanting a relationship. There's all sorts of tactics that are used in the recruitment process. But essentially, the most common storyline is that there was an exploitation of a need, and that individual began to meet that need. And as a result of meeting that need, gained trust and loyalty in a relationship, and down the road was able to use all of that and manipulate all of that to turn them into someone that they can use for a commercial gain.
What is life like for most women once they are involved with these sex traffickers?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, obviously every situation is different, but sex trafficking is a very dark and very traumatizing experience. Often, as graphic as this is, often victims are sold multiple times a day to strangers. Often they are sent into hotel rooms to meet people who they have no clue who they're going to meet. There's a lot of violence attached to sex trafficking. There's a lot of sexual assault attached to sex trafficking. And I think one of the biggest factors of sex trafficking is the loss of control over your life. And this varies with the severity of a case, but you will often see that that pimp or that recruiter, whoever it is that is selling that individual, has reduced their control, and that pimp has worked their way into full control of that, even an adult's life, to where their choices are severely limited and everything about their life is dictated by someone else. So often the money that they're making, they never see it. The money goes straight to the pimp, all the way to very severe cases of a pimp telling someone when they can eat, when they can sleep, how much they can eat, what they're allowed to eat, even restricting water. We just recently had a case where food and water and even electricity in the home was restricted as punishment for certain things. And so I think it's important for people to understand that sex trafficking is an incredibly traumatic experience, that it is a crime, but it's different than other crimes. Victims of sex trafficking have endured more than just being sold sexually against their will. often that is one of a myriad of things that has happened to them. And I think one of the key factors that makes it so traumatic and so deeply traumatizing is that it's every single day, typically for an extended amount of time, that this trauma is happening. It's not just a one-time occurrence. And so it becomes a chronic trauma that they're experiencing. And so every case is different, but every case is deeply traumatizing.
So it's more than just a physically abusive situation, is mentally and emotionally and probably spiritually abusive as well.
Yes. So every level of abuse typically is happening. And what we find is that the physical abuse you can heal from relatively quickly. It is the emotional, relational, mental, and spiritual abuse that can take years to heal from, because those are internal things that have been manipulated. So often you see every form of abuse taking place in a person's life.
Are there specific signs that we might could notice that someone is being trafficked?
Yeah. So before I give a few signs, I think what's important is to sort of highlight some high-risk populations. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's really hard when, if we think about sex trafficking, we think every single person is vulnerable to it. It becomes really difficult to identify who actually is vulnerable. And so we always try to paint a picture of who is most likely going to be vulnerable to being recruited. And so these risk factors come from our region. So in the US, but specifically also in Louisiana, the first one is poverty. If poverty is present in a person's life, that makes them very susceptible to being manipulated, because they have a lot of needs, especially if that is generational poverty. If they've been born into and have lived in poverty. Poverty places people in survival mode, and survival mode, when you're in survival mode, you operate differently than when you're not. And so often poverty is somewhere in the equation of a victim's story. So that's one risk factor and sort of high risk population. Another two that kind of go hand in hand: foster care and children who have run away from home. Those are probably the highest vulnerabilities when it comes to kids to being recruited and trafficked. The main features of why a child that's run away from home is automatically in survival mode, but because children cannot consent to do anything, they need an adult to do everything for them, which makes them very susceptible to being recruited and manipulated by an adult who can actually provide the things that they need. Kids in foster care often are also kids who have run away from home. So those kind of go hand in hand. But in the foster care system, you have this a group of children who, although foster care is an incredible answer, what we have to recognize is that for that child, it is the worst day of their life when they go into a foster home, because they have lost their biological family. They've lost, even if it was a chaotic environment, it was the one that they knew. Mm-hmm. And they've lost all of that and are now in a brand new environment with strangers. And what that creates is this innate desire for them to find the place that they belong. And one of the most used recruitment tactics of pimps is providing a place that people belong. And so makes them very susceptible. Another high-risk population are drug users, because an addiction is a very easy and quick hook for someone to use to gain full control over your life. If you are an addict and someone begins providing that drug for you, there is an automatic dependency that has been created. And so those are some examples of risk factors. I forgot one, the last one being individuals who have experienced sexual abuse. There is the latest kind of stat that came out about this. It was about 5 years ago, so it's a little dated, but the last time they studied this, a study showed that for adults in the sex industry, that 93% of them had been sexually abused as children. And so it just shows you sort of the correlation between those two things. So those are some high-risk populations. And that's important when you're talking about signs and symptoms of it, because a lot of the signs and symptoms alone by themselves may not necessarily mean sex trafficking. But if you pair the signs and symptoms with the high-risk populations, that gives you a clear picture that something may be happening. So some common, I mean, we don't have time to go into all of them because there's a ton. You can literally go on Google and become an expert in the signs and symptoms of sex trafficking, but just some prominent ones that we typically look for or hear about when people report it. For adults, if there is a third party present, if there is a person present that seems to have control over anything in their life, for example, if in a hospital setting, there is an adult in the hospital, but there's another adult present that's answering questions, that seems to be restricting dialogue, or other situations could be there's an adult that has someone else that has their birth certificate, their ID, things like that. So for an adult, any kind of dominating presence of an adult who's not, if I'm an adult and I'm not in control mm-hmm. of anything, it could be conversation, what I'm saying, or my identifying documents, that is a red flag. Still in the adult category, small things like if they're going through their purse in front of you and there's motel keys, multiple motel keys, that could be a sign, at least that they're engaging in prostitution. Tattoos and branding is another one. Often pimps will use the same symbol, the same name, the same phrase on multiple victims. And so that can become a way that you can sort of build a narrative that maybe there are multiple people being trafficked by the same person. Someone restricting their travel or restricting their social circles. Isolation, if someone is isolating them, and that can look like you don't need anyone, you have me, or we're not going to go to the hospital because we can't trust those people, or we're not going to call the police because we can't trust them. All of that is sort of isolating behavior. That's also something that we listen for and watch for. If an individual has a sudden change in what they have access to materially. So if a person typically is existing in poverty and then there's a sharp change and they have a brand new phone, they have a brand new designer bag, maybe their nails are done, their hair's done, all of a sudden there seems to be a sharp change. That's often a sign that at least recruitment has started in someone's life. For kids, some red flags are truancy. So missing a lot of school, being a recurring runaway child is also a red flag. Multiple pregnancies, that goes for adults or children. And with that, multiple abortions, repeat STDs, that is a big red flag. With a child, it's harder to know if the person present is their guardian or not, because a child always has or should always have a guardian present. But if that guardian present, if there's not a line of proof that they're an actual guardian, that's another red flag. For both adults and children, if you're encountering someone that doesn't know maybe where they are, what city they're in, transient, they don't really have a permanent address, they're just traveling or they're just moving through. We could go on and on and on and on, but those are some of the red flags that we look for.
Why can it be difficult for someone to leave when they are being trafficked?
Wow, that's a great question. So I think the most obvious one is that there is often retribution for attempting to leave and it not working. Mm-hmm. So, but to me, my answer is one of the biggest reasons why it's hard for women to leave is because they've been emotionally manipulated. They've been manipulated to believe that if they leave, no one will help them. They've been manipulated to believe that no one can be trusted, that no one will believe them. Often they have been manipulated to believe that this individual truly does love them and truly does have their best interests at heart. And if you're in need of that and you've never had it, that's very hard to walk away from for some individuals. Often it's hard to walk away from those relationships because they are providing for their actual needs. And when they walk away, they lose access to all of that. But typically it is very difficult to leave a pimp because of the physical ramifications of that. And often a pimp has a network of people in a city. And so you may be able to get away from that individual, but it's really hard to stay away from an individual. And so I think that's kind of a complicated answer, because I think there's a lot of factors at play for why it's difficult to leave. But the biggest one being, the biggest ones being retaliation and sort of the retribution of trying to leave and it not working, and sort of what happens to you after that. I think that's a big looming fear for a lot of the women that we serve. And then also just the level of manipulation that they've experienced, it becomes very difficult for them to see the truth and very difficult for them to choose freedom, because their minds have been warped by an individual, sometimes for years. So it's different for every person. But I think it is important for people to know that it's not just a matter of, well, if you don't want to be there, leave. It's almost impossible to get away.
How does the Hub locate or come into contact with women who are being sex trafficked?
One big way is that we have a 24-hour hotline that we use as the reporting hotline for this community. So a lot of the individuals that we end up serving come to us through that hotline. We also have community partnerships all across Shreveport-Bossier, everywhere from hospitals to schools to the hospitality industry. And we're training, we're constantly training on how to recognize it and what to do. And so a lot of times victims are identified by those partnerships, whether that's the school system, a hotel worker, an ER worker, you know, a nurse in the ER remembers the red flags and sees it happening in front of them and then calls that hotline number. And then we do a lot of outreach as a ministry. So we are constantly going into the jails, doing visits in the jail to let the women in there know about the resources available. We go to motels in the city. So I think it's a combination of all of that. And we've been here for 15 years. And so at this point, there is sort of a known idea that if you need help and you are in this industry, this is the number to call. So I think that that also helps us.
Based on your experience, who is at risk for willingly being drawn into prostitution and this way of living? And I would like to know also, do you still consider them to be victims?
So a lot of the same factors that pull someone into being recruited by a pimp are some of the same factors that pull them into prostitution in general. Poverty and survival mode, that is one of the biggest factors for women in the sex industry as to why they start, because there is this sort of allure of easy, fast money that they are kind of in search of because they're in impoverished situations. But some of those same factors apply to women who are not being recruited by a pimp, but some of those same reasons, survival mode, drug addiction, sexual abuse, things like that, are still at play. And, you know, do I still consider them a victim? I think a victim of sex trafficking, maybe not, but because there's so many other things happening, you know, one of the things I say is that a lot of times for a woman in prostitution, prostitution is the least of her problems. And so often, maybe a woman hasn't been a victim of sex trafficking, but they are a victim of domestic violence, sexual assault. There's so many things that they've walked that often they are a victim of something. If they've never been under the sort of the hand of a pimp and never experienced that, then no, I wouldn't consider them a victim of sex trafficking. But there often are so many other things at play that they have actually been victimized by. And then the other answer is that sometimes when they get their bearings and begin to tell their story, you realize that they actually have been a victim of trafficking at some point in their life, that they've, because that line is very fuzzy, that they have had a boyfriend that forced them to do those things, or they have had a drug dealer that forced them to do those things. And so it may not be the standard like Hollywood version of it, but often women in prostitution have actually been victims of sex trafficking before, but they did not know that that's what was occurring. So it's kind of a blurry line between the two. Mm-hmm.
So when you're reaching out to women who are the victims of sex trafficking, how do you work to build a relationship of trust with these women?
Consistency, being present a lot, showing up over and over and over again. Another thing is just being present and not asking them to do anything. not having a premise of, hey, we're here because we want you to fill in the blank. We want you to join our program. We want you to get out of prostitution, but just saying, hey, we're here for you, period. And doing that for a long time, a lot of times, with no return on that investment often, at least not early on. And so I would say consistency and honesty with them and transparency that just says like, hey, we're here for you regardless of the choices that you make, but we do believe that God has a different plan for you. We do believe that what you're experiencing is not his design, but we are in your corner. We are in your life until you have that epiphany. And so a lot of it is just consistency and doing what we say we're going to do. That is a big part of building trust with this population, is if we say we're going to do something, we have to make sure that we follow up and actually do what we said we were going to do. So it is a very difficult thing to earn the trust of women who have been exploited. And it's something we hold as a really high honor when they do trust us, because we know that they have a million reasons not to trust anyone, much less strangers that have just shown up where they are. And so we count it a huge honor to be trusted.
So your mission is the restoration of lives. What does restoration look like?
So the way that the Hub defines a restored life is we use four R's. So we believe that if a life has access to these four R's, they are on the pathway to seeing full restoration. The first R is rescue, which kind of speaks to what we've been talking about, but the physical rescue out of life-controlling situations, whether that's sex trafficking, domestic violence, drug use, living outdoors, environments that are not conducive for restoration. Because the truth is, if someone is in a life-controlling relationship or environment, they do not have the ability to focus on their future. They don't have the ability to focus on recovery or their future restoration. So rescue is the first R that we look at. Do we need to provide a way out of a situation that they may find themselves in? Now, they have to choose the way out. They have to choose to want to walk out of what they're experiencing, but we take very seriously our job of creating that pathway out. The second R is relationship. So we believe that a life has to have access to two primary relationships. One is a relationship with God and a relationship between them and the Lord that is healthy and stable. And the other is a relationship with a community. And so we believe that that is the work of the Hub, is helping create community for marginalized populations. And then through our programs and through how we operate, teaching them how to create their own community. So that's the second R, rescue relationship. The third R is resources. So access to physical resources. For full restoration to come in a person's life, we do have to actually address the physical material lack that they're experiencing. And so we work really hard to make sure that those physical resources are provided. And then the last R is recovery, both substance abuse and recovery from trauma or mental health recovery. So we believe that as they engage in a relationship with the Lord and as they begin to understand all of the things that God thinks of them and his word and his promises, we also have to have these other things at play. We cannot just have one element. We have to have sort of this full picture happening so that that life can be restored spiritually, but also physically, mentally, and emotionally, so that they can go on to live a stable and self-sustained life. But more importantly, that they can live out the very purpose that God created before they were even born, the very purpose that he created them to live out. And that's the goal, not that people stop using drugs. That's not the goal. Obviously, that's what happens in this process. But our main goal isn't just that they're not prostituting anymore. Our main goal isn't just that they're not homeless anymore. Our main goal is that all of those things are true and they have been freed up to walk into the very unique calling that God has created them for. And so we don't want to stop until we see those things happen. And so we sort of aim at full restoration because we want to see people go on to live not just stable lives, but full thriving lives. And we want to see them walking out that intention that God had for creating them.
I would think throughout this process, the women have probably lost a sense of their identity and a sense of their self. So is that also part of the recovery process, possibly recovering their identity?
Yes. So our programs, as far as curriculums go, are designed to sort of aim at all of the root issues and all of the residual effects of the sex industry, one of them being identity. And so they walk through curriculums that are aimed at helping them rebuild all of those ideas, not just who am I, but who is God and who can be trusted and what's my purpose and all of those things. All of that has to be rebuilt after such a traumatic experience. And so, yes, we do work really hard to help them put those pieces back together.
How does the Hub rescue children out of sex trafficking?
So just like on the adult side, through all of our community partnerships. So when we do a lot of work on the prevention side for kids, so we work with high risk populations, kids that are more susceptible to being recruited. But when there is a victim of trafficking that has been identified, that's a child, we work with the whatever agency has identified them, or if we have, we work to do wraparound services. So make sure that that child gets access to everything that they need. We work with the systems in place to find housing. And then much like what we offer adults, we have the same set of resources for children. And we basically just put together a sort of tailor-made program for that child to be able to walk through, but some of the same elements, but it's just geared towards children.
Are women and children being brought here from other cities and states and trafficked in our region?
Yes. So there are different versions of human trafficking happening in our community. One of them is interstate trafficking. So the moving of people down interstates across state lines. And so we do see that often. And a lot of times what that looks like is individuals have met someone through social media who, through that social media account, has recruited them from a distance, has groomed them from a distance, and now they're traveling. Sometimes they travel on their own volition to Shreveport or to Bossier, thinking a version of a reality about that relationship that isn't true. And so often it's not people being forced to move across state lines. Sometimes they're coming here on their own, but they're coming because they've been recruited and groomed online, and they're coming here as a response of that. And get into these relationships and realize that they are now in a situation that they cannot get out of on their own.
So what happens to women and children who are brought in from other cities and states? What happens to them once they're rescued?
Yeah. So for an adult, we give them back the full power of choice for what comes next for them. Often they are from another city, but they don't want to go back to that city because of factors at play, whether that's maybe that's where this trafficker is from, maybe that's where their drug dealers were from, or whatever it might be. So if that's the case, we help them identify if they want to stay here and engage in our programs, or if there is a place anywhere in the US that they feel comfortable going, or if they have family somewhere. So we work with every victim that we come in contact with, adults, to determine what is the best next step for them. For kids, the way that the system works for a child, because a child cannot consent, mm-hmm. is that if a child is identified in Louisiana and that child is from another state, the child is automatically transferred back to the custody state. So if they're identified here in Louisiana, but they're from Georgia, then Georgia's foster care system will send a representative to bring that child back, because that is their custodial state. So when a child is identified here that isn't from here, we often don't get to serve them for very long because they're transferred back to their state of custody.
Do you think it's possible to end human trafficking?
Yes, I do. I think it's possible to end it in a single life and to do that over and over and over again. Because I watch human trafficking end in someone's life almost every day. And so my answer to that is yes. I think a lot of times people answer that And they think as a global scale, right? Like end it all together and it never exists. And while I do believe that anything's possible because God can do anything, my answer isn't that. My answer is yes, human trafficking can be ended and it can be ended in a person's life. And you can do that over and over and over again. And to me, that's what matters more because that life has been freed from human trafficking. And when you do that over and over and over again in a community, you do start to see a change. You start to see the numbers drop. You start to see things shift. But I try to always focus my answer to that on, yes, human trafficking can be ended in a person's life. And if we band together, we can do that over and over and over and over again. And that one person's life is worth all of the work and all of the effort to see it end in that person's life.
Can you tell me about your program, Stripped University, which helps women who have been engaged in exotic dancing?
Yeah, so that is our resource for women in exotic dancing, and it is geared towards very practical resources, classes about budgeting, job employment readiness, job connections, helping them make a transition from the sex industry into a different career. So that's sort of our resource for women that are coming out of that.
Do you find that a lot of those women do want out of the industry?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, again, it depends on, it's all case by case, but I do think that often you find the reasons they are in that industry are not because they want to be or because it's the career of choice. And so it is a very slow process to work with that specific population. And so we just consistently offer resources, medical care, counseling, GED programs, access to employment, things like that. And you do find that as you build trust and as you work with individuals and as you form these relationships over time, often they do want out of that industry and can walk across that bridge into the next part of their life.
Which other cities in the country now have a hub ministry?
We have one in Fort Worth. We have one in Ruston, which is kind of a regional one. It's Northeast Louisiana. We have one in Lafayette. We have one in Macomb, Mississippi, which is just a small city. We have one in Las Vegas. And we are working currently very early on with Denver and Los Angeles and Memphis. So those are like the next three over the next 2 years that we will be developing.
How can other cities bring the Hub Ministries program to their city?
So you actually, a really practical step, they can just go to our website, thehubministry.com, and there's a section about it and they can say, you know, I want to request to know more. So it's on our website.
Do you know if the pandemic or our current economy has been affecting women being trafficked or choosing to work as an exotic dancer or in prostitution?
Yes. So the pandemic, a lot of individuals lost employment overnight, and that forced a lot of people to make decisions that they prior to that moment would not have made. Mm-hmm. It drove a lot of people to the sex industry, mostly online, because there was no way to find employment quickly. So I think it did have some major effects when it comes to human trafficking. Because of the pandemic, for so long, the focus was on COVID and not necessarily on the efforts of human trafficking and marginalized populations. And so a lot of agencies closed down, a lot of things stopped happening in person. And so what happened from that is there were less eyes on people's lives. And so the occurrence of abuse and trafficking rapidly increased because no one was being identified because no one was meeting in person. And so it had a large effect on that. And also on the homeless and poverty population. The individuals we serve in poverty, that population expanded overnight because hourly wage jobs were gone and a lot of people found themselves unemployed. And until the unemployment things were cleared, there were a lot of people that were dangling over homelessness because they had no way of earning an income. So we saw a huge impact of the pandemic on that. And just the state of the economy right now obviously has even middle-class people feeling a strain. And so if that's true for middle-class, then it's a guaranteed truth for those in poverty. So I think that the pandemic and our current climate made those who were vulnerable even more vulnerable. It just sort of pushed them further into vulnerability and further into the kind of the fringes of society.
I see. Cassie, your services are offered with the assistance of volunteers. How can someone volunteer with the Hub, and what volunteer opportunities are available?
Yeah, we use volunteers for everything that we do. The Lovewell Center, every event we do is volunteer run. Our classes are taught by volunteers at both places, at the Lovewell and at Purchased. All of our outreach teams are volunteer teams. And so one, you can easily see every opportunity at the Hub on our website. If you go to thehubministry.com and click on serve, everything comes up and you can see every single opportunity. To serve with Purchased, you do actually have to go through a training. It's a mandatory training. We do every quarter, we do the Hub Equip, and that is a one-day training for anyone who wants to learn about the Hub, the Lovewell, Purchased. We teach about poverty. We teach about poverty alleviation. We teach about human trafficking. That is mandatory to serve with Purchased. It's not mandatory to serve on the Lovewell side, but we do encourage people to go through that training because it equips people to be able to serve the populations better. All of that is on the website, and it's super easy to navigate and figure out how you can get plugged in.
Okay, great. If we see someone that we do believe is being trafficked, whether it's a woman or a child, what should we do? What steps should we take?
Yeah. So if you are local, you can call the Purchase hotline, which is 318-230-7482. That's also on our website. Or you can call the National Trafficking Hotline. If the easiest way to tell you to do that is to go on to Google and type the National Trafficking Hotline, and it'll give you the number. If you call hotline, they will ask where you are. And then if you are in Shreveport-Bossier, they will connect you to us. So either way, you're getting connected to us. If you're not local and you call the National Trafficking Hotline, they will connect you to the closest agency in your area that can help that victim. So I would say automatically call. And then if you can't remember those hotline numbers, or if you don't have that in your phone, you can always call the police, and the police will eventually cycle you back to the same place, to the NGO that can help.
Once again, I'm Renee Moran, and I've been visiting today with Cassie Hammett, founder and director of the Hub Urban Ministries. You can find more information on the Hub Urban Ministries, Purchased, or the Lovewell Center at thehuburbanministry.org. Cassie, your story tells how one person can step up and step out to make a difference. And thank you for sharing your story and the mission of the Hub Urban Ministries with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.